Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for September 27th, 2018. My goodness, and I forgot to mention September 21st, last Friday, was the fall equinox, one of my favorite times of year. And for many people also, a lot of people love fall. The bugs are gone, the kids are in school, you know, the weather is cool and you know, it's usually a little drier, all kinds of nice things, the changing of the colors, you know, getting ready for winter, and people with, you know, sanity are getting ready to head south to their winter, the place that they have found to spend their winter, etc. And, of course, I like that old song. What is it? The words, I'll follow the sun. Anyway, that's what I like to do. If it's cloudy and raining, well, I like the clouds and rains, but I grew up in that cold, cold northern climate, and after a while, it kind of becomes too much driving down a road with, you know, unable to see, and the cars in the ditch all over the place, and, you know, a hair-raising experience just to get home and eat supper. Okay. Enough of that. Anyway, my new web page is almost ready to go live, and so keep an eye out for that. But remember that my old web page is still there, and if you are in need of water filter products, please help me out. That's my only source of income for this show and to match my many expenses that are going on. So if you need water filters, that's the place to go. So, jmccsci.com. You probably have heard, if you hang around the techie magazines at all, that there is a claim that has been surfaced this past week, that there was a solution to the Riemann hypothesis, which deals with prime numbers. And, of course, that's something that I have dabbled in, as you probably all know, solving the oldest problem. And by the way, there would not even be a Riemann hypothesis if I had done this back in the 1800s. The Riemann hypothesis was based on the Euler equation, or Euler, some people say, depending on whatever. But It's simply a very simple equation, very interesting equation that relates prime numbers to counting numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the prime numbers, and it relates them in an equation, a very interesting and complex equation. And Riemann took it into the complex format of that equation and then matched it to solutions of this what they call zero points, where the function crosses the zero line as you go vertical on the one half, basically, on the number line, one half. And the solutions, as far as they can tell, are related to this balancing of the prime number. And these are very complex topics. But as of today, there is no assurance that this claim of a Dr. Ataya, I believe, I don't know if I pronounce his name right, there's no indication that anybody else agrees that the Riemann hypothesis has been solved. And let me just put this in a little bit of perspective, since I have worked with prime numbers. And the generator function that I developed easily calculates directly the prime numbers. But not only one prime number, but it calculates them in groups. And it has some very interesting properties like symmetry and closure and reciprocity and many other mathematical properties that involve only the prime numbers, which is very interesting. And so I look at the prime numbers as an entirely individual group of mathematical entities not needing any of the other numbers. So it is not, my method is not a sieve, which is kind of like a child's, kind of a puzzle that you can discover the prime numbers, but it doesn't give you any predictive value. My method does give you predictive value, and it's so effective, and that is why many people are breaking the encryption codes. I have a book, it's called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, that shows you how to do that, to break the RSA codes, which are based on the product of two prime numbers to equal another number, but these are very big numbers. And I go through it in great detail on how to do this very simply and how to break the encryption codes very quickly. In fact, I know people that are in business that have SSL or secure socket layer encryption, or they may have encryption for their business, and they have received key encryption codes 3 or 4 or 5 times a day, because that's how fast these codes can be broken. But anyway, back to the Riemann hypothesis. There's a great book called Prime Obsession by Derbyshire, and he's a Nobel Prize winning economist, but fabulous, fabulous book, which really, really goes into the Riemann hypothesis in detail and for many different levels. Even if you're a beginner, you could read the book, or even if you're a well-seasoned mathematician, you could read the book and gain something. But in the very end, he says that the Riemann hypothesis, and this is very true, the Riemann hypothesis, even if solved, is not the end-all. In fact, it's a very minor, it would contribute a very minor amount of understanding to the world of prime numbers. And so that it's been overhyped. But I'll give you a little fun fact here, that when the millennium problems were defined back in the early 1900s, the Riemann hypothesis was listed with two other prime number problems. The one was called the Goldbach conjecture, and the other one was the twin prime conjecture. And so I'm not going to go into detail, but it was not only the Riemann hypothesis that was listed in the millennial problems. However, when the Clay Institute came along with its millennial problems and $1 million prize, it only selected the Riemann hypothesis to be included in the prize money. And so anyway, the Goldbach conjecture and the twin prime conjecture, the twin prime conjecture basically queries whether there is an infinite number or not of twin primes. Twin primes are like, say, 11 and 13, or 29 and 31. They differ by 2, so therefore they're called twin primes. And so the question is there an infinite number of them, or is there not? Because they get more sparse as you get up to bigger numbers. But anyway, I'm not going to go into any more detail than that. And the Goldbach conjecture has to deal with products of prime numbers and even numbers. So it's a very subtle and one of these problems. And there are dozens of problems dealing with prime numbers. But it appears that all the fanfare over the solution of the Riemann hypothesis was very premature. And this is unfortunate because it takes away from the legitimacy of people who are working on these problems. And the way, now, unfortunately for me, when I did my solution, I sent it off to a peer-reviewed journal only to find it in the quagmire of a lot of controversy and politicization of mathematicians, because my solution for the direct generation of prime numbers does not include mathematical analysis. Now, I took mathematical analysis as a college student, And I, by the way, have a bachelor's degree, a double major, mathematics and physics. And so I also taught mathematical analysis at the college level and amongst many, many other courses, statistics, etc. But mathematical analysis is basically a class of mathematics that's very complicated, basically dealing with statistics. And since mathematicians did not know how to directly calculate prime numbers, they started looking at all types of statistical methods of analyzing prime numbers and the density of prime numbers, how many prime numbers, where's the next possible prime number, etc. And then I'll also mention that when now and then occasionally you hear that, oh, the largest prime number has been calculated. And people go, ooh, isn't that tremendous? And it's, you know, so many millions of digits, etc., and calculated with a computer. But what they're doing is they're fishing in what we call rich areas. And, for example, there's certain classes of prime numbers that have a potential, of a higher potential for being prime than other types of numbers. And so Mersenne primes is the what I'm talking about here, if you're familiar with mathematics. And so they look at numbers that are multiples of 2 plus or minus 1. And so those are fertile areas for trying to find, so the 2 to the power, to the nth power plus or minus 1. And those are fertile areas to look. But they don't calculate all the primes between the last one and the next one. They're looking in these fertile areas. It would be like, say, you were searching for gold. And you didn't look all over the world. You just went to the places where you knew pretty high probability that you're going to find some gold and probably some pretty big nuggets. And so that's similar method as one if you were dealing with, say, Mersenne primes and looking for those to be prime. And that's typically what they find with computer searches. And so these are computer searches. When my work on generating prime numbers was published in 2007, two things happened. The Clay Institute changed their rules, not allowing my work to be used as a method of solving the problems. And the organizations that sponsored the what they call the Great Mersenne compilation problem, in other words, they use people's home computers and the mathematical the ability to calculate. And so people are calculating small pieces of the search for prime numbers. And then the end result is that possibly you, if you were joining this, you could be the person that ends up actually having your computer discover the next large prime. But it's not the next large prime. It's there's an untold number of primes between the last discovered prime number and the next one. What my method does, it discovers all the prime numbers, all of them. And it does it in a very systematic manner and gives you understanding. Okay, so anyway, I could go on and on about prime numbers. It's a topic that I love and something that I certainly will be getting back to as soon as my life in the world of energy and water and, in a sense, saving the world when I get back to normal. And I always had to joke with a woman I used to be on her show regularly. Her name was Jackie Petru. And I was a guest on her show a lot. And one day I was talking to her. We were getting ready for an interview. And I said, Jackie, next week, after all this is done, my life is going to get back to normal. Or I should get back to normal. And she laughed. She said, Jim, your life is never going to be normal. And she was right. It only gets worse. It gets worse all the time. More busier and busier. I just want to make a quick comment about the political situation in the United States. And you could not, I mean, if you certainly all have been exposed to this 27 Ring Circus. I mean, the soap operas shows in, you know, on the afternoon are probably hurting because there's so much drama in Washington, D.C. these days over the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, about allegations, and both sides screaming and basically going bananas over all of this. But I want to tell you, in the background, the elections, or fall elections, are coming up here, the midterms, and there is going to be unprecedented cheating on the side of the Democrats, because they know, in spite of their phony polls that they always present to make it look like they're doing good, that they're going to have a tough time maintaining the Democratic Party. And I mentioned this on John Moore's show and a few other shows where I've been a guest recently, that this issue of cheating, you have to get out and vote, because as in the 2016 presidential election, people went out en masse, and there is some kind of an illusion that they're trying to present in the mainstream fake news media that there is somewhat of an even race. And it's really not true at all. Around, I would estimate that 80 to 90% of Americans support Trump. But that's not what you hear on the fake news. You hear, oh, he's losing support, and everything's going crazy. It's really not true. And so don't believe that. Trump has about 80 to 90% of the support of the country. It's just that we depend on these news services, which basically fabricate whatever they want. But the reality is that the Democratic Party is not doing well, and the only way they can win is by cheating. And I outlined my top 11 ways of cheating in an election back during the 2016 presidential election. And what we discovered was that one of the biggest forms of cheating was right at the precinct level, where the people recording the votes and then sending them up to the state level, they were actually just changing them right at that level. So if you can, in your community, become politically aware and get into the place where they're actually counting votes and tabulating them and sending them up to the next precinct level, because that's one of the major locations of vote rigging. And that's why Democratic strongholds like Chicago or New York City or L.A., I'm beginning to be of the opinion that a lot of the Democrats, for example, in California, probably have never really won elections. They just have cheated. And so those are locations where they've got their cheating method down. Anyway, enough of that, but get out and vote. And there's a whole new laundry list of Republicans that are supporting the Trump agenda. So go out and find out who they are and vote for them, because it's going to take a lot of extra votes to overcome the cheating that's going on in the Democratic Party. And I predicted that the Democratic Party will basically go under in this midterms, and they know it also. They're so scattered. They're in such disarray. They don't have a platform. They don't have a consistent set of candidates. And, you know, they don't really have a set of policies. They don't have anybody that's run a business. They don't, the majority of Democrats have never run any kind of business. So how can you run a country just with these grandiose, you know, verbal promises of you know, success and wealth and betterment for everybody, when they really don't know what they're talking about? It's just baloney. It's the same baloney as always. And also the blacks and the Hispanics, one thing we found out in the last election is that, and what's going to come up in this election, is that the blacks and Hispanics, which are the two really largest groups of populations, what they call minorities. I don't believe in minorities. I just believe that everybody work hard and do your best. But they voted primarily for Trump. which is very interesting because they want to protect their ability to earn money, have a decent job, pay low taxes, and not be railroaded into this Democratic Party that has basically had false promises since I was a kid. Okay, enough of that, but get out and vote. Okay, so now I'm going to dive into this topic. I really like this topic. I started it last week, or maybe even a couple weeks ago, the Comet K2. And I'll be talking some more about this. And these discussions will help you understand celestial mechanics a little better. Now, I understand things on many different levels, from mathematical level, the equations that govern the motion of the planets and the moons and the stars, etc. And so I understand those, and I also understand on an empirical level, and so I can talk about it. For example, the comet K2 was discovered way out there, and they say beyond the orbit of Saturn. Well, it's not coming in the plane of the planets. It was discovered way above the plane of the planets. So the discussion or the statement that it would be beyond the orbit of Saturn is a little misleading, but you know, for the average person, they're not going to, you know, really understand even what that means, let alone put that into perspective with the model of the solar system, because Comet K2 is coming in from the north. It's not coming in the path of any planets. And so now I want to talk about small perturbations. Well, a perturbation is, by definition, a change in the orbit of a planet or comet or moon or whatever. Perturbation is a change from its normal path. And you could use that in describing persons. They're perturbed or they're taken out of their normal path. So now let's take an example. And this, of course, comes into play when we're talking about, say, objects, near-Earth objects, NEOs, that would potentially crash into Earth, causing havoc. Now, there's two ways to look at this. If you were trying to say you knew exactly where this object was going to go, and say you knew that it was direct collision course with Earth, I mean, it was going to hit, and you wanted to deflect this object, push it off, go out there, put a thruster on the side of this object, push it out of the way, and so it misses Earth. Okay, well, that's a great idea. Probably good for a Hollywood movie, but the reality is, as the object comes closer to Earth, you have to put more and more force in changing its orbit. But if you knew years and years in advance, just a little nudge would have the same effect over a number of periods of years, because just that little nudge, that little perturbation in its orbit is going to change the orbit. After a long, that change adds up over time, etc., until, you know, years later, that orbit has changed so much, it's so far away from its original orbit, because you gave it a little nudge in the very beginning. And as I said, if you wait until this object gets very close to Earth, then you have to really put a lot of effort in moving it so it doesn't collide with Earth. And now let me repeat, though, K2 is not destined to crash into Earth. It's nowhere near it. It's way outside the orbit of Mars when it comes in. But some things could happen, as I talked about last week, where it could have its orbit changed and, in fact, have a significant interaction with Jupiter, which would be quite the light show. But the end result is we simply don't have any data that it would indicate that Comet K2, is a potential threat for Earth. But anyway, now let's analyze this a bit further. So if we go to the mountain of Haleakala in Hawaii on the island of Maui, there is a major facility there. It's a military installation with all types of infrared, especially infrared and optical tracking equipment to track any object in the solar system, literally to detect and then determine orbits, etc. And so connected to these telescopes also is the probably the largest computer array in the world. And that's saying a lot, given that Google and other centers like YouTube, etc., have vast, vast capabilities. But in terms of calculating, etc., this installation in Haleakala in Hawaii is just mammoth, and it's for detecting and calculating orbits. So there's two parts to this. There's first the procurement of data, which you have to depend on telescopes, take the position of the object, the angle, etc., with respect to Earth, and on repeated nights, or possibly weeks apart, you take continuing data that shows this object with the background and the stars, because that's our perspective. And of course, Earth is moving continuously as we go around the sun. So there's a lot of factors involved here, but the end result is that you can get a very good close estimate of the orbit of something, some object out there. And that's the case with K2 also. However, with a comet, you have this issue that you really don't see the nucleus. You see this coma that might be 100,000, 200,000 million miles in diameter. And actual object in there is relatively small. Even if it's planetary size, it would be relatively small compared to the coma, this gaseous cloud that surrounds the comet nucleus. So, given that, and given the fact that observations are not exact, they're close, okay, so there's some error there. Now throw in the fact that there could be changes that occur that we really don't take into account. For example, what if an object, and there are many of them out there in outer space, it's a big area and actually is pretty empty, but there's a chance that this nucleus or this asteroid or whatever it is, not only K2 but any object, could be hit by something relatively small or potentially something large to change its orbit. And we don't necessarily get to see all of this. Okay, in addition, we have the comet, which is discharging the solar capacitor, and the tail drag is causing the nucleus to change its orbit. Okay. Number two, then you have to take this data, feed it into the computer system, and then start crunching numbers to actually calculate its future orbit, going around the sun and all of the interactions that it may have with other planets, etc., especially Jupiter and Saturn, the bigger ones. That's going to change its orbit. But there is such a thing in any kind of computer analysis that's called rounding errors. The numbers are only so big, and there's ways to mitigate this. For example, you take and you create a calculation of an orbit using, say, standard accuracy with your numbers. Okay, now you increase the accuracy. You increase, actually decrease the time between samplings in your computer program. Then you do other modifications to make your calculation more exact. But every time you do this, you get a rounding error. And so there's kind of a limit to the amount of accuracy that you can get by making calculations. And there again, it's very similar. The farther out you take your initial measurements, the more error you're going to have. The farther down the line you make these calculations, the farther down the line you go, the more there's a probability, a possibility that your object is not going to be in the orbit that you believe it's supposed to be in. And so here is the end result. If you detect something early and you make a calculation of its orbit, then other things can happen that would throw it off considerably farther along in its orbit. And so these parameters are constantly being updated with better calculations, with more data points, etc. But if you are given the job of deflecting an object so that it would miss Earth. Okay, so you take your measurements, you take your calculations, you put all of this together, and you say, ooh, this one looks like a potential Earth-threatening object, and you find this maybe 2 or 3 years in advance, then you could give that object a little nudge, and it would then, after passing for a couple of 2 or 3 years, it would miss Earth. But what if you're rounding errors? What if you have not accounted for rounding errors in the computer? What if you had not accounted for the very good possibility that the data, the measurements you got of position, velocity, etc., at the very beginning were erroneous? And what about unknown factors like tail drag with a comet or being hit by objects in outer space that you didn't plan on, you couldn't see? Your assumption that this object is moving through free space and not colliding anything is it's an okay assumption for most applications. But if you're talking about celestial objects that could potentially do harm to Earth, then that would be a completely different story. Because you want to be very exact. In fact, you could push it, thinking that you're pushing it away from a collision with Earth. And in fact, because of faulty data or rounding errors in the computer, you would actually be pushing it to where it would have a collision with Earth. So do you see the problems here? These are just technical problems trying to solve an issue that objects could come close or have an effect on Earth. Now, let me make it clear also that a big comet like K2, and it's going to be big, would not necessarily have to touch anything. Like it could have reactions with Mars, Jupiter, or even Earth, potentially at a distance. And that's one of the terms I coined in my work. You'll find it in the book Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. My other books also where I talk about action at a distance, where the electrical effects primarily, or gravitational, electromagnetic effects and gravitational, can all take place at a distance. You don't have to have things collide. So, for example, 1999, I always refer to this. I saw a small comet, got the data on it, and then realized that there was going to be this amazing set of planetary and lunar alignments at that time in this particular comet was going to interact with Earth. At a new moon passing, there were all of these other electrical conditions which allowed me to make a very good prediction regarding the eventuality of hurricanes. And so, but a small comet can pack a wallop because it's not the size of the nucleus necessarily, it's the size of the discharge and the proximity to the object that it's potentially moving towards and going to interact with in some manner, not necessarily a collision, but maybe at a distance. So action at a distance is a fundamental property of my work and essential to understanding that things don't have to hit you to have an effect on you in outer space. So let me explain this possibly in a different manner. Imagine there were gremlins in outer space, little aliens or whatever. Now, this is imaginary, so it's kind of fanciful. And you wanted to say, okay, in 1,000 years, we want Earth to have some kind of calamity. And you knew that there was a moon out there or a planet or a comet, or let's say, that if you budged it just right, would take a little bit of force right now, it would move out of its current orbit and then eventually end up with a near collision course with Earth in 1,000 years. Just imagine that you're trying to plan this. Well, the problem is that when you get into these types of problems, orbits, even though we'd like to think they're very predictable and there's no outer space resistance media, that everything works exactly according to Newton's law, the reality is that that's simply not true. And so to affect Earth in 1,000 years, you would have to have some a lot more calculation than just the orbit based on where the object is right now and what the path is that is moving right now and where it's moving. Because things can change. And a lot of times, those changes are not predictable. You'd have to have a tremendous amount of data. And, for example, say the tail drag on a comet. And tail drag also can affect smaller objects, asteroids, that are discharging the solar capacitors, just that we don't see their discharges as full-blown comets because they're just small and have a relatively weak interaction. But we just don't have enough data. I mean, we could make some round calculations so that the comet nucleus, for example, would be picking up material and therefore changing its orbit because of tail drag, etc. And so, but it'd be very difficult to understand at a given time in the future what elements would be and what abundance they would be in the solar system, because that's the source of material for the tail drag. So prediction is it's a good idea, but understanding it completely is very difficult. Something that I guarantee you the people, at least for sure the tier two people at NASA, don't understand. And so at any rate, I'll keep talking about Comet K2 in the future, but I wanted to give this little synopsis so you understand better about the difficulty of actually calculating and predicting where objects will go. And for something to have a direct collision, it's very difficult for a single object. But of course, there are things, material, rocks, etc., coming into Earth every day. Some of them bigger, some of them, the vast majority, just grain-sized, that have come in from outer space, that are just, flying around out there. We don't know where all this stuff came from, although people try and guess. I don't really put much credence into that. But the end result is that predicting the path of a comet, for example, or another object is very difficult. Okay, so off to another topic. I believe it was last week I talked about the solar observatory in New Mexico being shut down. And there's really no new news on this. There's the official explanations simply don't make any sense. That there was a janitor. This was, by the way, the official explanation. I'm not sure if I talked about this or if this was information was available for my show last week, but the reason they evacuated this solar observatory in New Mexico and the local post office allegedly was because of a janitor who had pornography on site, or pornography dealing with children. And so if you look at that, if they knew about that and they wanted to go in and arrest this guy, okay. But there's no reason to take everybody out of the facility and the local post office, because this guy certainly cannot be in two places at once. So the explanation, the official explanation, simply does not add up. The local sheriff from that region was very perturbed because he was not brought in on anything, was not told anything. The solar observatory being closed, and there were rumors, although it's not very clear at this point. It's not clear that this is true, but there was evidence or rumors, let's put it that way, that this was not the only solar observatory that was closed around the world. So something appeared to be going on. Certainly there was something else going on at this place in New Mexico. And the guy could only be in one place at one time. Anyway, whatever the case, their The official excuse simply did not add up. But what I said all along was that when you see things like this, it's a preparation, and we're coming right up to the nose-to-nose with the midterm elections, that would be a way of preventing voters. They could have a running blackout in certain areas where they knew voter turnout would be very high for Republicans, say, and target that area for a blackout on the evening of the voting or a couple days before. Now, I've said also that I predicted, and of course this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek prediction, but if it came true, I wouldn't doubt it, that they're going to send a hurricane into southern Florida right before the midterms to cause complete and utter chaos. And, of course, to allow for extensive cheating to go on in those regions. So, once again, get out and vote. This is an extremely, extremely important midterm election, and it will literally shape the political climate in the United States and really for the world over the next 30 years. So, anyway, it's when you think that, oh, I'm just in the minority, or don't listen to those statistics, those polls that are trying to tell you that you're in the minority. That's not true at all. You are in the vast majority of people in the United States who finally have become fed up with the career, not only career politicians, but when you look at the Bush-Clinton cartel, these are actual dynasties where it's passed down from, you know, father to son to you know, nephew, is like royalty or something. So anyway. Oh, and I forgot. I just saw a note here, and some listeners actually were very interested in one of my comments last week about Comet K2 as it would pass through the asteroid belt. Now, this is very interesting because if the nucleus of Comet K2, now the coma, the gaseous coma, the cloud around the coma, or the cloud around the comet that we call the coma, really doesn't have that much mass. But the nucleus, if it's large, if it's, say, you know, Earth-sized or something, or the size of our moon, which would be part of the issue of it being an early detected large comet, that its nucleus would be significant. And of course, they lied their behinds off about Hale-Bopp. Hale-Bopp was very large, and I've learned a lot more about that. Of course, they kept that completely secret. But as K2, this comet, passes through the asteroid belt, which it'll do two times, once on the inbound side and once on the outbound side, it could, number one, have a flurry of activity that could potentially affect Earth, all of these asteroids coming out of their normal orbits. So that's one issue. And there again, it's really far away from Earth, at least the planned orbit of this object. And so that would not necessarily be a tremendous a high probability. It would be just rather low probability that we would get a few more asteroids than normal. But then again, some of these asteroids are nothing to play with. They could wreak havoc on a large part of the, a region, a land region, or hit the ocean and cause a tsunami or something like that. Okay, but this issue of it passing through the asteroid belt, if it is a large object which is significant, then it's going to scatter asteroids that are in well-known orbits. Like, we have the orbits for all these asteroidal objects out there in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. We have all of the orbits, not all of them, but for the majority of the larger ones. And if those orbits become changed because of the presence of this comet, then we know that it's not due to some fuzzy little snowball in there, but and we can actually calculate the size of this object. And this is something that amateurs can do. We no longer have to depend on NASA, because we know they're not going to tell us the truth. Never a straight answer, you know. But amateurs could watch the perturbations of asteroids out in the asteroid belt as this object moves through. It would be a number of days window of opportunity. So it's not like you have to spend the rest of your life doing this. But it would be interesting to, if, you know, we track asteroids that are in the area and watch their behavior and see where they go, how much their orbits are changed. And it would only take a couple data points to really give us a good idea of the mass of this object. This is Comet K2 again. And another thing that could happen, since this is a comet discharging the solar capacitor, and these asteroids are in a region where they potentially could discharge the solar capacitor when these close interactions occur with asteroid objects, we could start seeing these asteroids also connecting electrically or seeing flashing between the large comet and asteroids, etc. So anyway, that's could be a pretty good light show. It could be a very interesting time, and hopefully we would have public viewing using the expensive telescopes, etc., that we've purchased for the astronomers of the planet. It would be good if we actually got some information back that was useful. I'm kind of bouncing around tonight, so I apologize for that, but just the last couple weeks, things have been extremely busy here. But back to the National Observatory, the National Solar Observatory issue with them clearing that out, taking all the employees out by the FBI, not the local police. If this were, you know, like I say, the janitor with some kind of obscene material on premise, they wouldn't call in the FBI to close the whole place down. You know, the rationale or just doesn't meet it. You would call in the local authorities, including the sheriff, if that was his jurisdiction, found out in the country, not a municipality, but it would call in the sheriff and it would be handled locally in the local court system, etc. It's not an FBI issue. So their story doesn't add up, which it typically does not. But my point is that, back in the year 2016, Obama made a very quiet statement about preparing. It was like a presidential directive, the preparation of the country for a solar storm. And basically, there was some analysis, et cetera, saying that if such a storm hit the United States, it would just take us into utter chaos, which it would have. It took down the electric grid on a wide scale. It would potentially throw the entire country into chaos. So that was one of my points, too, is how do you tell that a power outage is a false flag? Well, one thing is that not every country is going to go along with this gig. So you would find electricity, say, right across the border in Mexico or right across the border in Canada or other locations where they do have power. Their power was not affected at all. But say the United States would have widespread power outages. And so that would be an indication that this was not a real event. In other words, a false flag. In other words, let me just give you one scenario, just to give you an example. The sun is brewing, and let's say that they would use this to affect the upcoming election, which they only have a couple weeks left, in October, basically. Before the November election. So say about the end of October, they all of a sudden they start to notice a coronal hole. There's a big fanfare. You know, back in the old days, they would have wanted me on many radio shows, which are basically disinformation radio shows, which I don't cater to those anymore at all. But imagine that the news media and NASA would come out and say, we told you so, there's going to be this massive solar flare and everything's going to go under. Just prepping the public, you know, putting the BS out there to prep the public. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, they fake the data. They fake the data by adding in big exaggerated claims or simply artworks, simply fabricated data. And then they say this massive solar storm is coming, and then all of a sudden they just pull the power. Well, it would fool, 90% of the public, maybe not, maybe 10% of the public. But a lot of people would be fooled, and of course it would hit on probably on your way home from work or rush hour traffic, wherever you were, and possibly rolling blackouts. It would be very easy to pull this a false flag, to pull it off. And so the end result is that there would be this massive NASA announcement, public media announcement, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the CNN, all of the major disinformation news outlets would come out and blast this all over the place that there's, a solar flare coming, and there wouldn't be any real solar flare at all. It would just simply be hype. But there are ways for people like myself to monitor this and understand if it was a actual event of some kind, or if it was like a false flag event, but to disrupt the elections. And then, of course, we'd have to have martial law, who knows what kind of lockdowns. And then the election would come, and they'd say, oh, well, we're having the election anyway, or one of their favorite ways of cheating also is to have pre-vote, the votes that come in prior to actual election day, because they can stuff those also. But this idea of a false flag event, which Obama had been preparing for, and which I had said all along, this is the big one. When they get ready, the deep state, when they get ready to pull out all the stops, that's when they're going to pull out the power outage issue. And I should mention, too, I was on John Moore's show yesterday morning, and it was about a week ago that a caller called in and asked about there's some signatures that occur on photos, and I'm not going to go into detail. It's too complicated a story, but it was some bogus information that somebody was misinterpreting pictures that occur on websites that show water content in the atmosphere. But I'm not going to go through all of the details there. But there is a lot of false reporting about one of the main ones is microwaves being used to control hurricanes. And it's just Looney Tune. These people don't have real physics backgrounds to understand what they're talking about. And if they did, they would understand how ludicrous what they're talking about. But anyway, just be prepared for that. You are also going to be bombarded in the next few weeks with all kinds of, just fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be Looney Tunes out there in the political world. But also just there's some people, and I don't know where they came from or who's paying their bill or their freight. Always look for one thing I always say, if you're going to look for somebody that is full of disinformation, look for the money trail. Who pays their freight? So if they have, that's the biggest indicator, is who's giving them the money to so-called succeed. And that's a lot of these people that are presenting false information don't look like they've been missing any meals. I know from running this show and my own webpage and everything for years and introducing books that have sold very well, etc. But those are just temporary financial things. They're temporary in that, when a book first comes out, you get a good rush of sales and then it tapers off. All of my books are still selling. People are buying them, but they're not on the New York Times bestseller list. Some of my books could have been, but I don't follow those trendy things where they're sold in the bookstores, etc. I don't play that game. I just publish my own books. People purchase them, and they're mainly to get information out to you, the public. So when I see people who are they're traveling all over, they're like I say, not missing any meals, then you start to notice that something is a little bit funny. Why are these people getting all of the money to be who they are with the spiffy web pages and, you know, the tours of speaking tours, etc.? But there's a lot of misinformation about weather control out there. A lot of misinformation. It's just bogus. And it usually takes the form of microwaves being used for weather manipulation, things like that. It's just, you know, excuse me, but it's just a bunch of garbage. So, at any rate, if you really understood how weather worked, you would understand the methods for manipulating weather. And what I did is when I invented my work and presented my work on weather modification, it was to help the world, not to take these tools and use them against people. And it's like any tool, it depends on who's using it, whether it's being used for good or bad or for, you know, molesting people or targeting people, groups of people, etc. Okay, just a couple quick stories. The moon Titan of Saturn, two stories that came out recently. One is that it has, of course, methane, which has been known for a long time. But the interesting one is that they're claiming that there are dust storms on the surface of this moon, which is very interesting because it would be only the third location in the solar system where such storm activity occurs. Earth being one, Mars the other, and then now the moon Titan of Saturn. But very interesting, and the way they noticed these was with electrical effects. They noticed the wind patterns, but the end result is that this moon has basically tornadic type activity, cyclonic storms, and of course that's due to the discharge of the solar of the vertical electric field. So interesting. I could go on and discuss that quite a bit more. I've only got about a minute left in the show, so once again I want to remind you, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. the water filters, everything there. We had a little bit of activity this fall, and but now things are kind of stabilizing. So once again, encourage you to support this show. And I know all of the alternative radio shows are out there. I hope you support all of them. And when it comes to buying water filters, purchase them from my website, because I have the best ones on the planet. They don't require add-on filters. And then, of course, all my books, etc., and the paid cast. Join that. An extra hour per week of deep dive science topics. And that's it. We'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.